Lecture 36, Moral Science and the Natural World.
In the previous lecture, I mentioned Kant's claim that Hume's philosophy had awakened him from his dogmatic slumbers. Now, that was at the level of epistemology, the level of knowledge, understanding, reason. But there was much more in Hume that awakened the whole world from dogmatic slumbers, particularly at the level of morality. Hume had made a very strong case for the proposition that our moral reasonings, so to speak, are based finally on considerations of emotion, sentiment, utility. That the grounds on which we judge things to be good or bad are not some abstract external moral reality, some real moral realm that we happen to discover, but the manner in which the event in question affects us cellularly, physiologically. The issue of morals is taken up in Book 3 of his treatise. And right at the outset, in Part 1, Section 1, he provides as a major heading, Hume now, quote, "Moral distinctions not derived from reason." Nothing could be clearer. Hume's moral theory arises from his epistemology. Once the problem of knowledge is solved, as it were, in favor of impressions and ideas, which is Hume's solution, moral issues can be collapsed into questions about what? Impressions and ideas. But treated in these terms, Hume contends, there would be little left of what we take to be the business of morals, which is to guide our actions. He makes his case with characteristic clarity. Quote, "Since morals, therefore, have an influence on the actions and affections, it follows that they cannot be derived from reason, and that because reason alone, as we have already proved, can never have any such influence. Morals excite passions and produce or prevent actions. Reason of itself is utterly impotent in this particular. The rules of morality, therefore, are not conclusions of our reason." Close quote. So again, what could be plainer? No reason can move a muscle or cause a gland to secrete anything. Events that arouse in us feelings of revulsion are judged to be wrong in virtue of the fact that we respond to them that way. And those events that conduce to human pleasure and happiness are, on the whole, judged to be morally right, and morally right for that reason. So, summed across all actions and possibilities, what we judge to be the morally acceptable course of action is the one that answers to the criterion of utility, general usefulness, pleasure. The business of moral philosophy, then, is not to attempt to deduce moral first principles. The business of moral philosophy is to come to grips with the nature of human nature and to recognize the obstacles, to recognize the challenges that that nature faces in a complex world, how it uses its own natural resources to frame forms of government, to frame moral propositions, to put together moral systems. Recall the subtitle of Hume's treatise. I remind you again of the subtitle, "Being an Attempt to Introduce the Experimental Method of Reasoning into Moral Subjects." The grounding of morality with respect to considerations of happiness and usefulness has proven to be profoundly influential, the idea that morals match up with utility and pleasure. The roots are very deep in philosophy. They extend back to the Epicureans. Now, the principal adversary to latter-day versions of utilitarianism is in the form of moral theories patterned after Kant's and referred to as deontological theories. The adjective is derived from the Greek deon, meaning duty. So what is central to any deontological moral theory is that it takes the imperative of certain moral precepts to be unconditional, such that an action of a certain kind is right or wrong under any and all circumstances, whatever the consequences. That is to say, find the right moral precept, and that moral precept is applicable in every imaginable situation. So considerations of utility, sentiment, emotion, and the like are entirely irrelevant. Deontological moral theories are explicitly opposed to utilitarian theories, explicitly opposed to the idea that something is right because it happens to achieve good or desirable outcomes, that something is right because, as it were, in your heart you know it's right. Now, Kant had a lifelong interest in the sciences, and he certainly was not at war with an essentially scientific conception of human nature. But what he did reject was the proposition that the merely natural dimensions of human life exhaust the characteristics, exhaust the essence of our humanity. Granting that human beings are in one sense natural objects is different from concluding that they are no more than this. Surely if a human being is dropped from a height, my favorite example, the rate of descent will be 32 feet per second per second. As purely physical entities, human beings are subject to all the causal laws of the physical world. Kant knows that. But human beings are also rational beings. And what that means for Kant is that in addition to occupying a natural realm, as all physical entities do, human beings who are rational as such occupies what Kant calls the intelligible realm. In the intelligible realm, we account for events not by invoking physical causes, but by examining reasons. That is to say, you understand the course of action taken in the intelligible realm by understanding the reasons that have guided the action. Now, the other feature central to Kant's moral theory is the autonomy of the will. There could be no morality at all, says Kant, except insofar as we have the freedom to act or not act as an expression of our authentic will to do so or to forbear from doing so. If our actions were entirely determined by our physical constitution, then we could neither be praised nor blamed for the actions. Our actions then would simply be reactions. The grounds on which we become subject to moral judgment, moral censure, any kind of moral judgment at all, are grounds of autonomy. There must be sufficient freedom for us to be charged with wrongdoing or praised for doing what is regarded as virtuous or worthy. So autonomy is the necessary condition for there to be moral ascriptions or judgments of any kind. Now, Kant is quite direct in saying that the kind of freedom at issue here can't be proven empirically, but it is established in another way. In the preface to his Critique of Practical Reason, Kant puts the matter this way, quote, "Inasmuch as the reality of the concept of freedom is proved by an apodictic law of practical reason, it is the keystone of the whole system of pure reason. And all other concepts, those of God and immortality, which, as being mere ideas, now attach themselves to this concept and by it obtain objective reality. That is to say, their possibility is proved by the fact that freedom actually exists, for this idea is revealed by the moral law." Close quote. Now here, let me say this is a difficult passage in Kant, and it's a distillation of a highly detailed argument that includes, as a factual premise, the presence within us, which is to say, our conscious awareness of a moral law. It is this, however, that grounds the concept of freedom. For were there not such a moral law apparent to consciousness, the concept of freedom itself would be unintelligible. It is useful here to recall in this connection Reid's critique of Hume on the matter of causation. Reid argued that the mere phenomena of constantly paired events would never by themselves generate the concept of a causal sequence. It's only because of our own intuitive understanding of ourselves as having the power to bring things about that we are then led to the belief that events external to our own will are similarly brought about by some sort of power. Kant's argument for freedom is similar. It is owing to our intuitive awareness of the moral law that we arrive at the concept of freedom. The means by which the concept is reached is rational, not empirical. There can be no scientific proof of freedom. What form do scientific proofs take? They generally take identifying the laws of causality. But how unsuited, then, would empirical methods be for identifying the laws of freedom? Let me stop here to clarify this point. Suppose you wanted a scientific proof that there is freedom. Well, what goes into a scientific proof? What goes into a scientific proof is establishing the determinative laws that make something the way it is. Well, this is so contrary to the very idea of freedom that you'd simply be using not just the wrong instrument to establish whether there is freedom or not, you'd be using one that defies the very concept of it. But Kant does talk about laws of freedom, even though it sounds contradictory. But it only sounds contradictory because one thinks of laws in the scientific sense of strict determinism. Now, autonomy is a word whose Greek roots are auto, or self-reflexive, and nomos, which is law. The morally autonomous person is not one who is lawless, but one whose freedom is governed by laws he gives himself. Do you see? Though not constrained by the laws of physics in this domain, the will is not anarchic. Were it lawless, Kant says, it would dissolve into an absurdity. Rather, and let me take another passage from Kant, a free will and a will subject to moral laws are one and the same. Close quote. This much ground covered, let's return to the utilitarian and passion-based moral theory advocated by Hume and examine Kant's critique of it. Now, suppose I say something like this. It's a beastly hot day, and I've been out gardening all afternoon. The throat is parched. Well, now I see a nice tall glass of lemonade, and I'm very thirsty. If I am to slake this thirst, well, then necessarily, I must drink something, and in this case, as that's the only thing available, I must consume that glass of lemonade. So there's a connection here, a kind of causal connection, between eliminating the thirst and consuming the lemonade. Now, I am operating in this circumstance under a kind of imperative. If I would slake my thirst, necessarily I must drink something. Let's say in this case I must drink the lemonade. Kant refers to all such cases as governed by what he calls a hypothetical imperative. It's a phrase you can find in Aristotle too. A hypothetical imperative. A hypothetical imperative decrees the following, quote, if you would achieve this specific outcome, necessarily you must do that, close quote. Now, Kant argues that hypothetical imperatives of this sort are invariably grounded in our natural being, where we are subject to the causal laws of science. That is to say, hypothetical imperatives are tied up with conditions of particular motives and wants arising within us as natural entities, as physical systems. We have the capacity to have thirst, pain, hunger, we can be overheated. These are conditions that descend on us in virtue of our being creatures of nature. In these respects, we're under some sort of coercive, even non-rational influence when acting on the basis of such motives and impulses. The coercive press of hunger, of thirst, frustration, visceral sensations, antagonism, worry, fear, intense pain. Now, in his Fundamental Principles of the Metaphysics of Morals, Kant addresses these hypothetical imperatives, noting that such an imperative, and here's a passage from Kant with respect to hypothetical imperatives, such an imperative, quote, only says that the action is good for some purpose, possible or actual, close quote. And he contrasts this with what he comes to call the categorical imperative, quote, which declares an action to be objectively necessary in itself, without reference to any purpose, i.e., without any other end, close quote. So note then the distinction between hypothetical and categorical imperatives. Now, noting further how the ends and aims of life change with circumstances and possibilities, Kant reduces choices in these contexts to prevailing hypothetical imperatives. Joining Aristotle as well as Hume, Kant finds an anchor point amidst the shifting choices of a lifetime. Quote, "There is one end, which may be assumed to be actually such to all rational beings, and therefore one purpose, which they not merely may have, but which we may with certainty assume they all actually have by a natural necessity. And this is happiness," close quote. Could have been Aristotle saying that. The rational beings here, however, are understood to be in a state of dependency, in that the goal of happiness cannot be attained merely by willing it. In order to secure such happiness as is afforded by the circumstances of life, the required virtue is prudence. And this is the disposition that will best support actions under any and all hypothetical imperatives. You see, even granting that we are moved by these conditions of the body, there's going to be a state of character that's necessary if these wants, desires, and aims are to be satisfied. Prudence is the one that Kant affirms here. Note then that the Humean desires establish no more than hypothetical imperatives. They work on rational beings in their condition of natural dependency. In these instances where we are under the general press of desires for pleasure or to avoid pain, the keen desire to avoid what is painful, we function as natural beings, dependent on the laws of natural causation. In a word, moral philosophy need not apply here, do you see? What you do in response to someone holding a gun to your head, this is not in the moral domain now. It's not what morality is about. Because in this domain, sooner or later, the right explanation of why I'm doing what I'm doing is not going to be in terms of a rational, autonomous being choosing a course of action on a ground produced by reason itself. Rather, it's going to be a course of action chosen by a natural kind of entity, essentially coercively worked on by the forces of nature and responding to its own internal physiology, its own constitution. Actions in that context really are more akin to reactions. So what Kant is setting up here, if you want to see the preeminence, the shadowy figure of Hume as the target, what Kant is setting up here is, look, the part of the story that you get from Hume really is outside of morality. It has to do with what creatures do under conditions of disturbance and desire. Morality, Kant argues, doesn't begin in that domain. Morality begins with a rational and autonomous being in the intelligible realm, the realm in which we are called upon to provide reasons for action. That is to say, if I take my hand off a hot stove, no reason for that action is necessary. That's a reflex. But when we move into the intelligible realm, where reasons and justifications are called for, what we invariably must find is a rule or precept or principle that guides actions of a given kind. A rule or precept that guides an action must apply to all situations of a particular kind. Now, one of the characteristics of a moral precept is that it's universalizable. That is, if it were not universalizable, it would be tied to a particular condition. And if it's tied to a particular condition, it's dependent on the merely contingent facts of the natural world. But when we consider bona fide moral canons, they are of the sort, do this, or thou shalt not kill, not thou shalt not kill on Tuesdays. Moral maxims, as reasons for acting, are applicable to all situations in which, generically, a given kind of action might take place. Now, as they are universalizable, they carry with them an imperative that is not hypothetical. It's not a case of, if I would get across the street then, or if I would slake my thirst then. Rather, these imperatives state, do X, or forbear from doing X. The categorical imperative is not tied to a particular desire or impulse or motive. Rather, It asserts its own moral authority. The authority of the imperative is contained in the maxim itself, not something that it brings about, not some contingent outcome, not some consequence as such. Now, before discussing Kant's versions of the categorical imperative, I pause to note what no less a philosopher than John Stuart Mill thought of the categorical imperative. He believed Kant's categorical imperative was a license to perform absolutely hideous acts. Well, perhaps we better see what troubled John Stuart Mill. I mean, if it troubled John Stuart Mill, perhaps we should be at least prepared to be troubled as well. Recall Kant's pure categories of the understanding. These do not supply content. Rather, they supply the overall framework governing the very possibility of understanding. The categories of quantity, quality, relation, and modality don't supply the understanding with specific content. That's the business of experience. So too with the pure intuitions of time and space. As intuitions, these do not supply a this or a that. Well, similarly, the categorical imperative does not supply moral content. Rather, it expresses the form of the moral law. Well, what is the categorical imperative then? This imperative accessible only to a creature that is rational as such. You are not a moral being because you are a human being. Any number of human beings can have no moral standing at all. Infants are not moral beings, on Kant's account. The profoundly retarded, I should think, on Kant's account, would not qualify as moral beings. A really serious defect in the nervous system might strip one of one's autonomy and rational powers, and thus remove one from the domain of moral beings. What constitutes an entity as a moral being is rationality itself, that it inheres in human beings, rendering us fit for moral judgment, happens to be the way things are. But we're not fit for moral judgment in virtue of the fact that we're human beings. It's in virtue of the fact that we are rational beings. Now, consider the successful insanity defense. The conclusion of law is that the perpetrator lacked sufficient rational power to frame means-ends relationships or to comport his behavior according to the requirements of law. The defendant, we would say, is not a member of that community found to be fit for the rule of law. Well, so too with human beings lacking autonomy of the will. Whatever else might be said, at least on Kant's account, they could not qualify as moral beings. Now, what then are versions of the categorical imperative? The categorical imperative is summarized this way by Kant. This is perhaps its most famous expression. Quote, "Act in such a way that the maxim of your action would, if you were able, be instituted as a universal law of nature." Close quote. Again, so act that the maxim of your action, not the physical details of the behavior, but the maxim of the action, the principle that that action instantiates, would be, if you could make it happen, instituted as a universal law of nature. You would make this principle dispositive everywhere and for all time, if you could. Act in such a way, so act, so comport yourself, that the principle on which that action is based, if you could make it so, would guide all action, everywhere and at all times. Now, you see, what troubled Mill was the prospect of, say, well, let's say an arsonist invoking the categorical imperative and wishing to install as a universal law of nature the successful destruction of property by fire. Well, all respect due to Mill, and it's a great bit of respect that's due to Mill, to be sure, but this fear can only arise from a rather daring, I should say, systematic misunderstanding of Kant's entire argument. First, any ignoble end, for that matter, any end whatever, tied to considerations of pleasure or keen desire or emotion, would come under the heading of a hypothetical, not a categorical imperative. Second, the imperative is a law that the will gives to itself. There are sufficient resources within Kantian moral thought to rule out arson as a candidate universal law. I think Mill was probably onto this. But Mill, by the way, is so opposed to intuitionism in all forms that he's going to have to be opposed to a kind of moral intuitionism. Now, Kant offers another version of the categorical imperative. Quote, "Man is never merely a means to an end, but always an end unto himself," close quote. Man is never merely a means to an end. Now, what is Kant getting at with this? Suppose I intentionally use another as an instrument of my purpose. If I intentionally set out to use another as an instrument of my purpose, then I am formally denying that person the standing of a morally autonomous being, which means I am prepared to suspend the presumption of moral autonomy, and that means I'm prepared to suspend precisely what is necessary for there to be morality at all. Now, moreover, if I'm prepared to install that precept as a universal law, I do so with the understanding that I, too, now qualify for such a treatment. Let's recall Abraham Lincoln's famous statement, "As I would not be a slave, I would not be a master." Do you see, the point that Lincoln is making is so coextensive with the argument that Kant has developed. The very institution of slavery establishes as a permissible maxim the use of another human being as an instrument. Well, who's to say in what direction that master-slave operation is going to work, do you see? Whatever principle would ground the right to use another person as a tool grounds the right to use other persons as tools. Man is an end unto himself. Kant is famous for concluding from this that one must never lie. Never, ever lie? Never, ever, ever lie? Not even a little white lie? Not just sort of making each other feel a little better? Well, we know Kant never married and presumably was not called on to judge the fall fashions. But consider the nature of the lie, and I want to say maybe consider the nature of the lie, big or small. If Smith lies to Jones in order to have Jones do something that Jones, if properly informed, would never do, then Smith is using Jones as a tool. He's using him as an instrument of Smith's own purpose. That is, he's trumping Jones's own moral autonomy and thus violating the categorical imperative. But what if the SS is at the door demanding to be told where the Jews are hiding? Now what does Kant say? What does a Kantian say? It's a vexing question. And I think the right answer, at least if you're a Kantian, the right answer is that a Kantian says nothing at all. Now, it's easy to make Kant into a kind of stick figure, Prussian, late 18th century, awfully formal, awfully abstract, utterly rationalistic. Life is richer than that. It's more robust, inevitably far more confusing than any system like Kant's is going to allow. But this is too easy, especially when alternative theories place the highest value on practical consequences. An illustration might help. Let's turn instead to one of the stock problems in ethics these days, let's say bioethics. An ocean liner has sunk, there's a lifeboat, the lifeboat can support 5 people, 6 actually made it through. Which one do we pitch overboard? Well, Mother Teresa says, let me jump in. You can work these scenarios out for yourself. And you begin to see what happens the minute you adopt consequences as the basis upon which you're going to treat people, and indeed the basis upon which you might be prepared to end their lives. There has to be something firmer than just a delineation of consequences. Kant's epitaph summarizes so much about Kant. The moral law within him, the starry sky above him. Kant, the starry sky above him, the moral law within him, and on Kant's account, within us all. Not as a way of gaining pleasure, not as a way of easing pain, but as a way of doing the right thing and thus instantiating ourselves as moral beings. Quite a contribution.